Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Vincent Crawford from the University of California, San Diego. Vince and I met at the European Economic Association's annual meetings in Milan in August 2008, where we spoke about his research program on behavioral game theory. I began by asking him to explain what this work is all about.
Well, behavioral game theory is basically an attempt to move the theory, the classical theory, in a direction that's more descriptive. And in principle, it has everything in it that behavioral decision theory has, plus something. My focus is on the plus something, the things that are specific to games. And the things that are specific to games are a new set of assumptions about how people model other people's behavior. So the thing that makes a game different from everything else is to know what a good decision is for me, I have to make some prediction about what you're going to do. And because your decision influences the outcomes of my own decisions. And we have a very well-developed theory in traditional game theory, which is based on equilibrium, the idea of Nash equilibrium. Basically assumes that people have perfect models of other people. And in reality, people not only don't have perfect models of other people, they have systematically simpler models of other people than would be required to be perfect. And in some situations, you can see this quite clearly in data, in the sense that there are things that are supposed to happen with equilibrium that don't happen, and things that can only be explained by other alternative models, as I'll try to explain. So that's the research program. For me, it's had two strands. One strand consists in designing and running experiments that are designed to measure people's strategic thinking more accurately. This has mostly been done with my former student and co-author, Miguel Costa Gomez, who's now at the University of Aberdeen. And then there's another strand where we sort of go out and take what we learn in the models and use them to try to resolve empirical puzzles. Empirical puzzles can be about field data. More often, they're about lab data. And this is usually done with people like my former student, Nagore Uriberri, who is now an assistant professor at Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona.
Okay, well, what I was going to say, what would be helpful, I guess, would be if you could give some kind of example of what it is that we're thinking about, you know, what the real world example might be of how people would be having a strategic interaction, how classical game theory thinks about it, and then how your new developing behavioral game theory approaches
so
it.
I'll give you two examples. One of them comes from a paper I published in the 2003 AER called Lying for Strategic Advantage. And there, the basic empirical puzzle I think of as being a question of, you know, how do you attack the European continent on D-Day? So the basic problem can be stylized in the following way. There are basically two places on the northern continental coast that you can think of attacking, Calais and Normandy. Calais is closer and easier to southern England. But on the other hand, the Germans knew that it was closer and easier, too, so the Allies thought that the Germans would tend to over-defend it. Normandy is further away and harder to get to, but also less obvious to the Germans. So you could stylize the situation as a game in which the Allies choose one of two places to attack and the Germans choose one of two places to defend. It's been explained to me how inaccurate this is. But I still think it's an interesting example. And the actual history was complicated by an attempt to deceive. So there was an operation called Fortitude, whereby the Allies set up a fake army around the Thames estuary, which looked like it was getting ready to invade at Calais. And the idea, of course, was to make the Germans think that the real invasion was going to be at Calais. Now, here's the problem from a game theoretic point of view. You can view the attempt to deceive as like sending a message about where you're going to attack. But the attacking game is a zero-sum game. Anything that's better for the Allies is necessarily worse for the Germans, and vice versa. And there's a very clear theoretical prediction that messages that anybody can send, messages that are called cheap talk in the literature, should be ignored in zero-sum, two-person games. Because if you found it optimal to respond to my message, your response would make you better off, and therefore, because it's a zero-sum game, they would make me worse off. So it's an annoying feature of equilibrium theory that there can't be anything like lying or successful deception. And in that paper, I took the model that comes out of the lab experiments called the level K model, which is related to what Kammerer calls cognitive hierarchy model. And I built a model of strategic communication in which there was kind of an integrated view of both what message the allies send and where they actually attack. The two things are part of a single strategy. And in that model, the most interesting prediction was that the Allies actually could fool the Germans, but they had to fool the Germans in the least profitable of the two possible ways. So in other words, they pretended to attack Calais, which is where they would prefer to attack if it was undefended, but in the end attacked Normandy. And there was no equivalent equilibrium prediction in this model where, I mean, the natural puzzle is, if you can fool the Germans, well, why not fool them into thinking you're going to attack at Normandy and also get the extra benefit of attacking at Calais? And it turns out that the level K model shows in a way that's too complex to explain here, but which is satisfying, theoretically, that that can't happen. It's actually a classical Chinese example, which is analogous to this, called Barang Dao, in which, you know, three millennia ago, a defeated general was being chased by a winning general, and there were two roads, a good road and a bad road. And to make a long story short, in that example, essentially the same thing happens. There's a successfully deceptive message, but it allows the deceiver, the pursuing general, to win in the less profitable of the two possible ways. So that's one example. Another example is it a paper by myself and Nagori Uriberry that came out in 2007 AER. It is something that I've been puzzled by for a long time, like 40 years or more. And I'll give you an example of a quotation which reflects a common form of strategic thinking that's not equilibrium thinking, but which is comprehensible in terms of these level K models. And it's something I read in a newspaper article in 2004. It's a quote, which is a comment on the poisoning of Ukrainian presidential candidate Yushchenko, now president of the Ukraine. And the quote is, any government wanting to kill an opponent would not try it at a meeting with government officials. So the idea is, you're going to try to poison this guy, whoever you are. And he's going to be having dinner with different groups of people on four different nights. You're the government. And one of the nights, he's meeting with government officials. So the question is, do you poison him on that night, thereby calling attention to the government officials, or do you not poison? Now, a game theorist, when he heard this quote, would say, well, if that's what the investigators are going to think, that's exactly when I would do it, because they're thinking, you know, that proves that I'm innocent. And it turns out that experimental results by people like Ariel Rubinstein and Amos Tversky have similar patterns in them, which are more precisely quantified, which I don't have time to go into detail here. But basically, what we show in the paper is that that kind of behavior and that kind of thinking is also accessible as or understandable as level K thinking. And in fact, that's the second level of thinking in a hierarchy of strategic thinking types that we characterize in the paper. So it's basically the basic idea of the model is the starting point for strategic thinking in the game is kind of an instinctive gut reaction to the game. So if you're trying to hide, for instance, on a landscape that has one salient, particularly prominent location and other things, the first thing you notice about the game is that one of the locations is prominent. That's like the dinner with government officials. If you're a government trying to poison this guy, that's the prominent thing. And then when you go up in the hierarchy, you sort of ask what would the optimal response to that be. And for a hider, he wants to stay away from prominent locations, but for a seeker, he wants to look for it. And what we show is that the right mix of people two and three levels up actually makes sense of the quote, and it turns out that the quote is the thinking of a person two levels up. So yet another example has to do with the interpretation of behavior in auction experiments, and it turns out that this way of thinking properly adapted to auctions sort of unifies a bunch of different results that people had separate theories of. If you know anything about auction theory, you know that everybody overbids in auction experiments, and there are two separate groups of theories about overbidding, one in which people have independent private values and they overbid for one particular set of reasons, and the other, they have common values and they overbid for reasons of which the most common one is the winner's curse. You overbid because if you win, it reveals that your private information about the value of the object being bid for is more favorable than everybody else's, and that means that it tends to be overestimating the value. And so the fact that that people don't seem to adequately take that into account, and therefore they bid too much. And it turns out that these models of thinking types give a sensible account of that too.
So in a sense, these models are providing a more realistic view of human behavior in these kind of interactions.
Yeah.
And presumably that has some kind of application in policy. I mean, one of your papers here is called Behaviorally Optimal Auction Design. I mean, I guess there are lessons about how an auctioneer would design an auction
in order to take
account of these sort of limited powers of reasoning that people have.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's early to claim applicability. However, as you say, the paper I presented today, the second paper I presented today, basically takes this point of view and uses it to think about the robustness of mechanism design. So the way in which mechanism design theory has been done, people assume equilibrium and they calculate the optimal mechanism on the assumption that everybody is going to play in equilibrium. Sometimes that gives mechanisms that are very rococo. You know, they're very complicated games that no one would be expected to play in equilibrium in the first time. They might eventually learn to play in equilibrium. And in fact, if people actually play them and they're not in equilibrium, the outcome could be very bad. So what we were trying to do in that second paper is basically say, suppose you had a population of people following these level K thinking types, what would be the optimal way to design an auction for them? And you saw in the analysis that the answer is sensitive to the shape of the distribution of private values, but that often you could design an auction that would get more revenue out of people than the best attainable revenue on the assumption that everybody was playing in equilibrium. Other examples might be just, you know, sort of creation of designs for things that don't require as much sophisticated strategic thinking. So one example of that I only briefly alluded to in the talk, in the FCC spectrum auctions, there's a very well-developed, very precise body of equilibrium auction theory, and when the designers thought about using it, they basically convinced themselves that people wouldn't play in equilibrium the first time, and there was no guarantee that what they did do would yield the predicted benefits. So what they did was they created a design that was progressive, where it was a little bit costly to put in and change bids, but you weren't stuck with your first bid. You got to see what the other people had bid and then adjusted to it, and things would keep adjusting until nobody did anything for a given period of time. And the idea there is that feedback that you get from what other people are doing is a substitute for strategic thinking. So you don't need to really figure out what other people's equilibrium reactions are. Rather, you can see what they actually did and adjust. And when everybody is happy with their adjustments, they're pretty close to an equilibrium, and the result will actually yield something like the predicted benefits. So that's the kind of, one would hope that you could use this kind of model to sort of formalize that idea in a way that, you know, in the next application, you wouldn't just have to use seat of the pants judgments to figure out what to do. You could actually calculate what the optimal way to do it is, pretty much the way optimal auctions are calculated on the equilibrium hypothesis. So I think there are potential policy applications, but basically the idea is to sort of try to make the analysis of strategic behavior less fragile and more like the way real people think, and therefore potentially more applicable.
So final question, I mean, how do you see the research program developing further, and the interaction between the theory and the experiments that you're doing and then the potential applications?
Okay, it's hard to see ahead, actually, but I mean, one thing that's very different nowadays than the way things were 20 years ago is that there's a continual feedback between empirical studies and theoretical studies, and I think that that's made the theory more dynamic, more exciting, and I think we're actually getting close to really understanding stuff that I thought would be impossible to understand just 10 or 20 years ago. Most of the empirical information is from lab experiments, because usually game theoretic models are very sensitive to lots of details that you don't observe and you can't control in the field. But people are starting to move more into the field, and there are occasionally examples of games played in the field where you can actually know enough about the rules of the game so you can test theories of strategic behavior. So I'm very optimistic about, you know, how the theory's going. But on the other hand, since, you know, we're on the frontier, we can't really see what's over the edge. You know, it's like it's very hard to predict what the next breakthrough is going to be.
Vince Crawford, thank you very much.
Thank you.